Welcome to 35 Minutes Ago, where we take a deep dive look at DC's event series, Doomsday Clock, from writer Jeff Johns, artist Gary Frank, and colorist Brad Anderson. I'm your host, Russ Burlingame, and I promise, there'll be more than just me. It's Thanksgiving here in the United States, so if you're an American, happy Thanksgiving. I wanted to do something to recognize the holiday because the reason that Doomsday Clock number 1 was published yesterday is because Jeff Johns has... Well, let's hear it in his words.
Yeah, it's funny. When we're talking about Doomsday Clock, I really was adamant about, I'm like, I wanted the first issue to come out at Thanksgiving, that Wednesday before Thanksgiving, because I remember as a kid, Thanksgiving holiday, and that Wednesday, going to the comic shop was like the greatest day ever, because you go there and you knew you had all this time with friends and family, and nobody was going to bother me reading my comic books. And I remember buying these issues, and there was this book called Justice League Quarterly. If anyone's as old as me, they might remember it. And it was this book that I think Keith Giffen wrote, and it was about the Injustice League, which is like Big Sur and these weird characters, but it was an 80-page book, and I was just so excited to sit down and read it. But I loved having, whether I was like on a plane or, you know, on a train or at home, during the holidays, it was just so fun to have like those comics I was so excited to read, and I wanted Doomsday Clock number 1 to come out during that same period, because for me it was just I have a real strong memory of joy, like great joy during that time, getting my new comics.
That was Johns during his spotlight panel at Comic-Con International in San Diego this summer. Earlier this week, Troy Brownfield and I shared our first thoughts on Doomsday Clock number 1. You can see those in the link below in the show notes. I will say that there is going to be a larger conversation that's much more in-depth about Doomsday Clock number 1 in specific with Troy, myself, and a pair of other panelists. But with the Thanksgiving holiday here in the United States, things have been a little crazy. I wanted to share something with our listeners for Thanksgiving, and I kind of felt like, what better than something that harkens back to Watchmen and something that, well, I already had in the can. As mentioned during our First Responses episode, I have a conversation that I'm going to be presenting today with Mike Brown, where we talk about iambic pentameter and how Shakespeare's use of same relates to Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons' use of the 9-panel grid in Watchmen. Obviously, the 9-panel grid is something that helps shape the look and feel of Watchmen and has also been carried over to Doomsday Clock. This is tangentially about Doomsday Clock, but you're going to see a lot of that. We've got episodes coming up where we're going to talk about the movie Network, where we're going to talk about Walden 2, and a number of other kind of ancillary projects. The hope is to give you as broad an understanding of Doomsday Clock and the cultural context of it as humanly possible. So without further ado, here's our conversation with Mike Brown.
All right, so we're here with Michael Brown. Michael is a learned comics fan and a contributor to comicbook.com. He's a friend of mine. And 4 years ago, was that right? You wrote this story about iambic pentameter and Watchmen.
Yeah, so I don't know how learned I am, but I am a comics fan. And 4 years ago for comicbook.com, I wrote an article about iambic pentameter, verse structure, and how that sort of relates to panel structure in comics in general and in Watchmen in particular. My college days, I thought I was going to be an actor. And as part of that, took a whole class on acting Shakespeare. And when you do that, you get a sense of, beyond sort of the literature of Shakespeare, how it works in performance, how it's supposed to hit the ear, how it's supposed to affect people. And this piece was inspired partly by that and partly by another piece that I saw on the internet about meter in the works of the Beatles. But in general, it's all about the way that these sort of ways of structuring other forms of creative expression relate to the way that panel structure works in comic books.
And with Watchmen in particular, the parallel between iambic pentameter and the 9-panel grid is interesting because I feel like part of it is a matter of the writer challenging themselves because they have created this kind of artificial construct that limits exactly what they can do.
Yeah, that's a big part of what the panel structure provides. It is a challenge. I mean, if we talk about, just, you know, in basic terms. Iambic pentameter in Shakespeare is just the idea that lines of Shakespeare are five pairs of one unstressed and one stressed syllable that form each line. And in poetry more generally, we have the even more restrictive sonnet form, which gets into even more particulars. That's typically written in iambic pentameter, but even beyond that, each sonnet's 14 lines long, it's in iambic pentameter, and there's typically only a few different rhyme schemes that are generally used. For instance, we have the Spenserian sonnet, which is A, B, A, B, B, C, B, C, C, D, C, D, E, E, each letter representing a rhyming line. But the general gist of it is you have the idea of placing restrictions on creative expression, which then forces the writer, the artist, to think of ways to be expressive within this sort of rigid structure. It is restricting, but at the same time, those restrictions can sometimes be inspiring in and of themselves. It's almost similar to when you see a really low-budget movie that finds some really creative ways to work around those limited dollars.
In the case of Watchmen, obviously, you have top-tier talent operating at the top of their game. How do you feel like limiting themselves by using the 9-panel grid worked to develop that story?
Well, in a way, when you look at Watchmen, I don't really think of it as limiting. I mean, it was obviously a very deliberate decision, and even on pages where you have complete 9-panel grids, during the dream sequence between Laurie and Dan's mm-hmm. dream, we have, I think, an 18-panel grid. At no point in Watchmen does it ever feel crowded. No individual panel ever feels rushed, overloaded, like there's too much detail or too little detail. But there is something about the panel structure that, in essence, by limiting themselves to 9 panels, they're able to then, when they do use larger panels or expand them either vertically or horizontally, the effect that they get when they deviate from a strict 9-panel grid or when they play with the 9-panel grid is really where the interesting effect comes in. Within the works of Shakespeare, the iambic pentameter provides a framework. But within the works of Shakespeare, sometimes the most interesting effects come when Shakespeare deliberately steps away from or subverts the iambic pentameter. So when in a typical Shakespearean situation, you have the ba-bum, 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 ba-bum that we all remember from school in the iambic pentameter. If music be the food of love, play on. Give me excess of it that serve fitting. So you go line to line to line. And in a way, to some degree, it mimics human speech, and it provides just a basic framework to hang the words on. But when Shakespeare deviates from that, then you get interesting effects. What would you say is the most famous single speech or soliloquy from Shakespeare?
The Horatio speech from Hamlet.
Right play, wrong speech. To be or not.
To be or not to be
is up there among the most well-known speeches. And the thing about to be or not to be is that is actually a deliberate subversion of the iambic pentameter because each line in to be or not to be ends with an extra unstressed syllable. That's called a feminine ending, and it's meant to signify confusion, an uncertain mind. To be or not to be, that is the question. So you end on that single sort of dangling, unstressed syllable. And at that point in the play, Hamlet is uncertain, confused, he doesn't know what to do. Should he kill his uncle? Should he not kill his uncle? So it's these deviations that really give Shakespeare's work its brilliance and texture. You have sections like the speech toward the end of Richard III, where the king has woken up from a nightmare, and the speech is all over the place. Give me another horse, bind up my wounds, have mercy, Jesus, soft I did but dream, coward conscience, how dost thou afflict me? It's lots of little bits of speech that make up entire lines. Usually in Shakespeare, you have a thought that carries through a line, but in this speech where you have an individual who is the night before a battle. He's woken up from a horrible nightmare. You have lines of iambic pentameter that are two or three ideas, just a few words in short phrases, and that shows a completely disordered mind. In these deviations from the iambic pentameter, you see the true artfulness. And in Watchmen, you have the nine-panel grid, but it's really a framework where you can put the more elongated panels, you can interpose past and present, you can interpose two simultaneous scenes that are taking place in different locations, and the deviations from the strict nine-panel grid are really the most interesting bits, and how all of that plays through and develops across the course of the series or graphic novel.
When you look at Watchmen compared to modern comics, there are many, many fewer major, like, splash or half-splash pages. Then when you get to 12, where the calamity has happened, there's, like, I think 4 splash pages to start the issue. How do you think that kind of major shifts like that compare to what you would see in traditional, like, Shakespeare or other kind of literature that embraces this kind of limitation?
I would say it's similar in some ways to, like, the Richard III speech. That character in particular throughout the play, if you're familiar with him, he's a devious character. He's in control. He, throughout the course of the play, he manages to woo the wife of a man he's just murdered, effectively. His speech is always, he's always one step ahead, always very clever, but toward the end of the play, he starts to fall apart mentally, and the speech I just referenced, the nightmare speech, where he's gone from iambic pentameter, knowing where he is, knowing what's going on, to falling apart. The speech just completely disintegrates, and that reflects his mental state completely. Mm-hmm. So that would be a similar sort of shift in structure that's intended to show a shift in the narrative or the state of being. And the shift in Watchmen from the more structured nine panels and the complete lack of any splash pages, mm-hmm, up until 12 is, I think, one of the genius moves, because those pages, with all of the detailed, horrific imagery coming so big and so forward at the beginning of an issue, but at the end of the story, is a real gut punch that would never have been able to be replicated if we had splash pages interspersed throughout the piece.
One of the things that I noticed about the 6-page Ashcan that's been released already is there's actually a page in Doomsday Clock number 1, I think it's page 3, that there's no page in Watchmen that actually has the exact same panel layout. How important do you think it is every time you see a page that is, quote-unquote, new for the first time?
You have to wonder, is it deliberate or is it part of their storytelling? Was that what served their purposes at the time? But whether it's intentional or not, it does serve to set apart the story they're telling. If this is something that isn't found anywhere in the original, this is obviously a continuation, a new take. And to so soon off the bat deviate from Watchmen's structure while still remaining true to the nine-panel grid in concept, that might be a deliberate artistic statement setting their work apart.
In my mind, a lot of the panel structures that you see in Watchmen, they eventually get reflected in a way that tonally or narratively reflects the original. What's interesting is that every page of the Watchmen Ashcan that we've seen reflects the corollary page of Watchmen number 1, except for this one page, which not only doesn't reflect its corollary page, but also is entirely different from any page we saw in Watchmen.
That is very interesting. If I remember correctly, there is in the Ashcan an image of Ozymandias' desk,
yes,
with the newspaper headline. That obviously is referencing the large two-thirds of a page panel that the similar view from the first issue.
Yeah, which in addition to the newspaper also had there's 3 action figures in Watchmen, but there's 2 action figures on his desk. But it's very composition-wise the same desk.
And that particular panel layout is interesting because you see that a few times in the first issue and then it pops up a few times later on. In the first issue, it seems to be associated with contemplation or maybe sadness to a degree. the first time it pops up is actually with Dan Dreiberg sitting facing away from his costume, looking rather dejected after his first meeting with Rorschach in years. Mm-hmm. And the time after Ozymandias, when it pops up, it has Ozymandias, Dr. Manhattan, and Dan in the same scene, but I would suggest that Ozymandias is really the focus of that one, and he himself is in a contemplative mood in the rain by the casket of the comedian.
Right.
So if we're to take that panel in the same spirit as these, then it's a spirit of contemplation, but lacking any of the core characters, except for the artificial facsimiles of Ozymandias, which could be a statement in and of itself.
Every time we see Adrian, he is gathering information. In Doomsday Clock, information is being replaced with propaganda. And so it's interesting to me, you're talking about kind of using this as a symbol of contemplation, when in Doomsday Clock, it almost seems like there's an element of rejecting deep thought in favor of sound bites and in favor of propaganda.
Well, in a sense, but if we're talking about Ozymandias collecting information, and I mean, all throughout the graphic novel, Ozymandias is in control. Even when he appears not to be, he's in fact controlling the narrative, controlling the actions. Really, I mean, the thing that is his undoing is the information that Rorschach collected, which is then followed up on. So in a way, the information and the media is undoing.
In the context of Watchmen, we hadn't really seen the rise of the kind of fringe conspiracy theory media at the time when the book was published. Obviously, by the time Doomsday Clock comes out, we begin with the mainstream media having embraced and accepted the Watchmen, or the Rorschach Journal. But we know from the context of Watchmen that it all began at the New Frontiersman, which to me, the New Frontiersman almost feels like InfoWars.
That might be dignifying InfoWars a little too much. Let's say maybe Breitbart.
Yeah, that's fair.
It is interesting to open up on a world that has so readily embraced the Rorschach Journal and the contents therein, coming from the New Frontiersman, which to all appearances is a bit of a fringe newspaper, or even a rag if we were to go that far. It'll be interesting to see if the piece explores how the narrative got away from Ozymandias as thoroughly as it has. You would think that with the news coming from that kind of a source, that he might have been able to spin it in some way or quash it, or
mm-hmm.
because even at the point where Rorschach finished compiling the information in the journal, he didn't know the whole picture. He knew how the pieces were coming together, but he at that point couldn't point to Ozymandias' ultimate gambit.
Which, of course, is somewhat reflected in the book, because in Doomsday Clock, they, among other things, mention that both Night Owl and Rorschach have been, I think it's retired for years or out of circulation for years or something. Certainly in Doomsday Clock number one, there's no indication they believe Rorschach died, which may be prescient because we obviously see him on page 5 or 6, but more likely than not is just a function of not knowing the whole story of what happened down there in the snow.
Yeah, when a man gets killed at the bottom of the world, chances are the news might not get out.
Johns has said not only are they embracing the nine-panel grid, they're embracing naked Dr. Manhattan, and they're very much letting Watchmen dictate the terms of the world in which they're telling Doomsday Clock. How do you, like, as somebody who's thought a lot about this, how do you think that affects the tone and the level to which people can accept this as quote-unquote canon?
Well, there's a lot wrapped into there. In terms of the use of the nine-panel grid, if I do recall correctly, at least one or two of the Before Watchmen graphic novels engaged with the nine-panel grid in some way, shape, or form. Although, from reading them and from what I recall, the criticism there would be while they used the nine-panel grid, they didn't really make use of the nine-panel grid in the way that the original graphic novel does. Mm-hmm. It didn't have the kind of artful mirroring interplay of scenes between two different time periods, locations, the way that the panels deliberately expand over time strategically. So if this upcoming Doomsday Clock is able to replicate that kind of thoughtful, intentional use of the nine-panel grid, I think that might be helpful to getting to seeing this embraced. Mm-hmm. And in terms of embracing the characters and letting them dictate the course of the event, mm-hmm. Or the miniseries, however this is being pitched currently, it's interesting. On the one hand, you could say that that is the best way to be faithful to it. On the other hand, does that mean that we're not going to have anything new, and it's just going to be spinning off of Alan Moore's ideas in a way that doesn't bring anything new to the table? It's going to be difficult, I imagine, to toe that line between respect to the original and honoring the original without slavish adherence to what one would perceive as the heart of it or the truth of it.
Obviously, I'll link in the show notes to the original piece, but is there anything that you really wanted to make sure that we said about the nine-panel grid and the way that it kind of functions within Watchmen that we haven't touched on?
Well, I mean, we've talked a bit about it. I do think that using the nine-panel grid, so it, to carry on the sort of analogy to poetry, the nine-panel grid in Watchmen provides a structure and provides limitations that inspire creativity. Modern comics very often, you would compare them to something like free verse or blank verse poetry, where anything goes, any panel structure goes, maybe not even panels, just what have you. I think that if they really embrace it and try to use it on a deep level, that could inspire some very interesting storytelling from them. And it'll challenge them to think more holistically, I think, about the series. I mean, as I mentioned, it does, the use of it does shift, and I think maybe even in the course of telling the story, Alan Moore and Dave Gibbons discovered some things they could do with it. If you notice across the course of Watchmen, the panels don't first open up in the last issue. All throughout the Mars issue, where we see Laurie and Dr. Manhattan, you see the panels opening up to deliberately show the expanse of Mars, the sweeping vistas, space. And one trick that I don't know that one necessarily thinks about it until one goes through the novel looking for the evolution of it, but you have the panels, and they typically happen, I don't know if this is intentional, between Dan and Laurie, where you'll have typically three panels across the page where the background and the setting don't change, but characters and time progress panel to panel to panel, and that doesn't begin to happen until about halfway through the graphic novel. So it'll be interesting to see if Jeff Johns and Gary Frank, if we see them developing and exploring new ideas and new ways to use it over the course of the graphic novel. Because in looking at Watchmen, the original, you begin to realize that Moore is doing something with comics that you can only do in the comic medium. And I think that's part of why people talk about Watchmen as being unfilmable. Mm-hmm. For instance, on the first page of Chapter 2, you get what happens fairly frequently. It's a traditional nine-panel grid, but every other panel is switching between the scene of the comedian's funeral and Laurie visiting her mother. And the way it's laid out in that manner, it's so on the top level you'll have funeral, visit, funeral. In the middle it'll be visit, funeral, visit. It's almost as if you're somehow, the two scenes are more fully interposed because they're spread out so equally over the page like that. And that's something
they're literally interwoven.
Literally interwoven. And it's almost as if they're happening simultaneously and you're seeing one through the other. And I don't think that's an effect that you can get in any other medium. And I don't know that it's an effect that a contemporary comic artist and writer would necessarily think to even try to replicate.
We talked about this a little bit before we started recording, but it's worth asking everybody who comes on, what is your kind of relationship to Watchmen, and as you look forward to the next year and change of Doomsday Clock, is this even a thing that you want to see?
My relationship to Watchmen is a bit interesting. my introduction to comic books was the Fantastic Four and Marvel Comics and sort of straightforward capes and tights heroism. Watchmen to me was this big imposing figure on the horizon of comics discourse and capital A art and comics. I knew about Watchmen for probably a decade or more even before I actually read the thing. And I even read, I might be getting this incorrect, but I'm fairly certain I read League of Extraordinary Gentlemen volumes 1 and 2 before I even got to Watchmen. So eventually when I came to it, it was a bit of a revelation. It at once lived up to the hype and completely justified everything that I heard about it previously. You read through it, and on the one level, it's just a really, really good story. I mean, the art's impeccable. I don't think you can point to a single panel or page that doesn't work in any respect. And the back matter in each of the comics, I've read through League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, and I can't bring myself to read Alan Moore's back matter in those. I don't know what it is about his prose writing there. I don't know if it's too stiff and stilted because he's writing it for the Victorian style of a travelogue. Right. But there's something about this back matter that really works and resonates, and that might simply be because it is more connected to the sort of superhero world and narrative that speaks to me. But in my mind, Watchmen really is an achievement in storytelling. Now, that said, am I looking forward to Doomsday Clock? I suppose my relationship to anything that's made, either a prequel, so before Watchmen, or this Doomsday Clock, is going to be colored by my perception of the deal that Alan Moore got out of DC. Legally, DC is in the right. They're abiding by all the terms of their contract. But in my mind, my understanding of the contract is that the contract states that DC would own Watchmen and all the properties until it went out of print, at which point Alan Moore would essentially get control of them.
Right. Typically at that time, the idea was, I think it was 1 year after it went out of print, the rights would revert to the creators.
Right. On the understanding that at that time there had never been a situation where a comic or graphic novel had just not gone out of print.
Right.
So while DC is abiding by the letter of the law, it's, at least to me, very evident that they're not abiding by the spirit of the law, of the agreement.
Right.
So to me, and to hear Alan Moore be so vocal in opposition to it, now, before Watchmen was an interesting case where I didn't read it at the time. I did borrow the collected editions from the library and give them a read through then, and they were good stories, well told, good art, but basically didn't really add anything, didn't detract anything. They were inoffensive. Now, at the core of Watchmen, to a degree, is this idea of the ambiguity. That at the end, Rorschach's journal is left at the New Frontiersman. You don't know, is Ozymandias' plan going to actually come off? Is this all going to come crashing down around his ears? Ozymandias says it's all over and this is the end, and Dr. Manhattan says it never ends. The ambiguity that's at the core of Watchmen, even before we see the complete first issue of Doomsday Clock, is to all appearances out the window. So it's hard for me to wholeheartedly endorse Doomsday Clock. I can't say right now whether or not I'm going to pay to read it at release. Knowing that it's going to come, regardless of anything I do, am I curious to read it? Yeah. I can't say I'm not. Gary Frank's an amazing artist. Superman, I imagine, is going to be in this somewhere, and he does an amazing Superman, and everything else, frankly. So on some level, I'm excited to see it. I suppose in the back of my mind, it's going to be a question of, do I pay to read it? And do I treat it in my own head canon as an Elseworlds tale? Because there is something about the original Watchmen by Moore and Gibbons that, because of its stature, because of the length of time that it went without a prequel or a sequel, because of the author's stance to it, because of the monumental place it has in the medium, it feels like anything that anyone tries to attach to it will never quite stick. So in that way, it's almost bulletproof in a way, regardless of what DC does. There's conflict there. I'll be curious and excited to read it on a certain level, but yeah, mixed feelings.
Thanks again to Mike for taking time out to talk with us. This was an article that really spoke to me when he first published it at comicbook.com, and I'm glad that we had a chance to talk about it at more length and in the context of Doomsday Clock. That's going to be it for today. Thank you so much for listening, and I'll see you in about 35 minutes.